Hi Sandra, mythical science is the topic that you selected. It is very much connected to that earlier topic of ignoscience. And mythical science is something I realized a long, long time ago. And the idea comes up again and again when people say E equals MC squared, or the theory of relativity, or in more general, as Einstein said. Of course, a lot of these things Einstein never said, but it just shows that there are examples where science or scientists are introduced in conversation or into the social dynamics as a myth, as in a mythology and a mythos. And a mythos is an idea which is fundamental and essential, but also, in a way, indefinable. So, what I would like to talk about in this exploration called mythical science is the fuzzy edges of science, the fuzzy edges of knowing, and the kind of saccadic movement which science has in ignoring or polishing away these edges where we don't know. And as the word saccadic movement already implies, I like to use so often what we can learn from our body. And in our body we are we have this blind spot, how we just can't see at the place where the neural net of the retina in the eye connects to the brain, because that's where the neural net changes from sensory cells to neural cells to go into the neural plexus to go into the brain. And so they are no longer sensory cells, they are relay cells. So you cannot perceive anything there, and you just don't see that you're not perceiving anything there, for the simple reason that the blind spot in the one eye, which, by the way, if with the optician's instrumentation, when you look into the eye, you can easily see the blind spot. You can see where the retina is absent, but you don't see it because there you don't see anything. You can see it, however, if you close one eye, and with the other eye you look straight forward, and the standard exercise is you stick out your arm with a fist and a thumb up, and then you move your fist from one side to the other, and then there is a moment that you do not see the fist anymore. So you just keep on gazing straight ahead. And from the periphery, you see that your hand, your fist is moving towards the center and then moving across, but somewhere in between it disappears from view. It's very hard to see because our mind has been trained to not look there, and as you don't see it, it fills it in. And it fills it in by a couple of mechanisms. One of them is memory. So the next image and the previous image in a way overlap, which of course is risky, because you need to know when things change. But that memory overlap is something which, for example, frogs and salamanders use when they are sitting on a branch, and they gaze into the universe, and when you gaze at something, the image disappears. And in their system, the whole landscape disappears, but things that move, they become visible. So when a fly goes by, that's the thing that they see, and then the tongue shoots out and grabs it, and they eat it. So in our eyesight, we have a similar kind of mechanism. We can perceive things by compensating it with memory. We also can compensate for the presence of the blind hole by the other eye, because the where the one eye has the blind spot, the other eye does not. So when you overlap two images and the blind spots do not overlap, then you have a total picture of the environment, and there just happens to be two areas where you have a less pronounced image on one location and the other location. And then in the way that the image is processed, then the image goes, compares left and right, compares what was before, comes after, and the brain then does a lot of filtering. But another form of filtering which is also taking place is that of the saccadic movement, the word that they used before, which is that the eyes, they fuzz over this blind spot by moving slightly, by having this shifty movement from one side to the other. They do a kind of tracking sideways, very imperceptibly. Sometimes people have a neurological stress as a result of which that mechanism, the tracking and compensation mechanism, doesn't work, and then you can actually see their eyes shaking, so to say, when they look at something. I needed to introduce this topic of the blind spot and the blinding out of the blind spot, because when we have the blind spot in our eye, we likewise have the blind spot in our mind. We no longer see the things that we do not want to see, the traumatic experiences. And then going from the blind spot in the eye to the blind spot in the mind to the blind spot in society, there are things that people do not want to talk about. Taboo was a favorite concept. Sexual taboo was a favorite among the taboo. So there were things that people were not supposed to talk about. And sex, of course, is a very interesting taboo, because everybody who doesn't want to talk about sex originated from sex. So it's kind of self-denial. And in this talk about idiots and idios, that's an example of where the denial then comes in. And in science, we have that too. So it's not just that people don't want to talk about sex in society. Medical doctors didn't want to talk about sex. Actually, when I entered medical school, they had that questionnaire which basically said, "Oops, are you aware that you will be seeing naked people? Are you aware that naked people might have something to do with sexuality?" So with big letters, I wrote on that, "People, please grow up. Sex is a solution and is not a problem." But it is a mindset which then kicks in to compensate areas where people are afraid to explore. And it is intriguing that in medicine, they never entered into the topic of sexuality. In science, they never entered into the topic of consciousness. It's only recently that they sort of started to go there. They don't even see the connection between the two topics yet. And as a result, we live in a society in which many areas of knowledge are not addressed. And that becomes even more puzzling when you see that there are lots of knowledge which we cannot address. So ignoscience talks about the need to study what we ignore, including what we cannot see and cannot know, because our knowing is not limited by our knowledge. In ignoscience, I talked about the difference between the baby with a capacity to learn and the scientist who thinks that they know, because there's things that have been observed and memorized. But in ignoscience, the crucial part is that we cannot base ourselves on memory, if we want to get to know the unknown. And that brings us back to this story. Science is the mechanism for angst reduction for humanity. Science needs to look into the unknown. Science needs to explore the taboo. Science needs to sail to the edge of the flat earth where the dragons are and discover that the earth is round and there are no dragons. And by exploring the unknown, science then needs to deal with the unknown, needs to address the unknown, and Ignoscience talked about that we need to acknowledge what we do not know, need to map out what we do not know, need to find pathways to access and address the unknown, because it's not just that we do not know collectively, but we also do not know individually. But if we do not address what we do not know individually, if the scientists ignore their blind spots, then they can be, as was addressed in the previous discussion, simply be idiots. They have limited themselves into a specific belief. The idiots is also locked in into a traumatic memory most often. So when people lock themselves into a limited belief and are not willing to explore it, it's like they dug themselves into a hole and they cannot look out of it. That's one of these time vortices of Einstein, so to say. Black hole experience. But if we are dealing with that kind of limited science and the limitations of the scientist, then we also need to acknowledge that a lot of science is actually limited by those limitations, that the understanding of science is not complete because it ignores what it ignores. It is not correct because it doesn't account for what it ignored. It is not accurate because what you ignore might totally change the meaning of everything involved. And it's actually not real. What science does is sciencing. It is a realization. Every description of science is a formulation of our realization. Every scientific object is a linguistic object. It is a model. It is a representation. And as the Bible puts it, do not lose yourself in idolation. Do not take a graven image or a symbol as if it represents something real. It is not real. It is a model. And in science, this has been ignored, which means that a lot of the knowledge of science is mythical. Not mystical, mythical. Let me first explain the difference between mystical and mythical. Mystical is based on the realization that there is more than we can know, but just as the baby can learn to know the unknown, the mystical, the mystery schools, rely on our innate capacity, say that of the baby, to get to know the unknown. And the reason for that is simple, same as described in Tetrionics. We are part of the universe is in us. By getting to know the universe in us, and by getting rid of the obstructions within us, we can experience our universal experience. It simply means that in us we have the capacity to experience and explore the whole. But, and that's the essence of mystery training as well, you need to look beyond what you see, you need to think beyond what you can think, you need to know beyond what you can know, and that is then the essence of what's called the mystery. There is more, and if you just open yourself to it at some time, in some way, you'll find a way to grasp it, or it'll unfold itself to you like a kind of rear view mirror. You can suddenly look around the corner and understand, oh, but if it is like that, then it implies that it functions like that, it comes from there. Mystical understanding. mythical understanding is very different. It's when you assume that you know something and you project it on something that you do not know, and then extrapolate that in a way that you cannot know, and then try to come to conclusions which essentially you cannot conclude. And mythical knowledge is very often seen by people quoting something which they do not understand, and as a result want to come across as if they do understand. Mythical science is really fascinating because it is that indefinable edge between what we can know and what we cannot know. And as the famous example shows it, when they looked at the fractals in measuring the shore of, in that example, it was the island of England. If you look on, say, a satellite image of England, you can trace the contours of the country and then say, well, the border, the borderline of the beach, of the shore of England is that specific length in kilometers or miles. But then when you zoom in, you get closer, you see, well, I actually need to include all of those islands because they form part of the England too. And then when you zoom in further, you can see that there are rocks outside of the beach in the water, which are part of England too, and so you need to include their circumference too, so the shoreline becomes longer and longer and longer. And then when you zoom in more, you realize that the shoreline actually goes around this grain of sand, so you cannot do the short circuit and just cut across from one side of the sand to the other, because it actually goes around that bit of sand, so you need to add that half millimeter or more. And the more you zoom in, the longer the shoreline gets. And science in that way has an edge of what it can see, and the more you move in on the edge, the more you can see detail, and the more you need to look at. Bhagwan Sri Ramanish, also called Osho, at some point said, the more you analyze, the more you need to analyze, because the more you differentiate, the more you need to differentiate. The more you zoom in, the more you will need to zoom in, because you discover that you cannot go into the detail of it until you reach the quantum level. And that is where we can then immediately step to the next perspective of this story, of this exploration of mythical science, because when you look at what science knows, most of it is mythical. There are a lot of formulations and expressions which are being used in science which are totally, absolutely mythical. There's nothing to prove it, nothing confirm it. Because yes, from the satellite picture you might have the impression that the contour is that, but when you look from the balloon, you can see that there's rocks out there and there's other details that you need to take into account. And when you look at the grain of salt and sand under the microscope on the beach line, you see that there's more to be taken into account yet. So in that sense, science zoomed in when it went from studying matter to studying molecules to studying atoms to discovering, as Tetrionics did, the quantum domain. Tetrionics didn't discover the quantum domain, but Tetrionics gave a way to understand the nature of the quantum domain. So that's where it first became accessible or addressable. But it became addressable, accessible only as a model, for the simple reason that we cannot see a quantum. We cannot see a photon. We cannot see an electron. If you go back in history, people already conceived of the atom in Greek antiquity. The idea was that if you have a bit of cheese and you cut it, you have two halves of cheese, you cut it again, you have two smaller new bits of cheese, you cut it again and again and again, and at some point you can cut it no longer because the cutting edge of the knife cannot cannot work with that anymore. You cannot cut it because the knife is too large. So it is atomos, uncuttable. And so atomos, it is the uncuttable bit. So for a long time, that was just an idea. And then, say, a few hundred years ago, it was possible to look at things differently. The telescope had been created. Turn it around, you have a microscope. So in one way you can look at things which are large and far away. Turn the other way, you can look at things which are nearby and very small. And as a result, it became possible to shift the attention from matter to molecules to atoms to quanta. But in that transition, there was a fuzzing which took place, because yes, we can see the materials. We can not see the molecules, we cannot see the atoms, we cannot see the quanta. In came the microscope. We can perhaps see large molecules or the effect of large molecules. In came the electron microscope. Now we can see molecules. In came the radio spectroscopy. We cannot see the molecules, but we can see the effect of the molecules because they change things around, which we can then show. And in came the scintillation techniques. You can shoot electrons onto atoms and get a scintillogram. The electrons bounce back and they can interact with photographic paper, and if you do that often enough, you get a scatter diagram, which gives you the impression of where the atom is, even though you cannot see it. So in that way, it becomes possible to, from seeing, to switch to indirect seeing, to switch to derived seeing, to going to the invisibilities, that what we cannot see. That is something which we also have in science. The parallel of looking with your eyes, looking with the microscope, looking with the electron microscope, to looking in an indirect manner, is what we see in science, and then it's called physics when we look at the material stuff. It's called chemistry when we look at the molecular stuff. It's called quantum mechanics when we look at the atomic stuff, and it's called tetrionics when we look at the immaterial stuff. So by having this shift of perspective, there was also a shift in filling in. That's why I started this story with how do we look at our blind spot where we cannot see. We know that there's a memory part to it. We know that there is a saccadic movement part to it. We know that there is a compensation part to it, the one eye seeing where the other one cannot see. And in the same way, in science, physics can look at one thing, chemistry can see the same but see something totally different. Physics looks at the structure, chemistry looks at the process, quantum mechanics then looks at the underlying transformation, which are in electromagnetic. Actually, it looks at the electron leaps. And then tetrionics finally came to look at what we cannot see. So in that transition, we needed to change our perspective. The classical scientist was an outsider observer, looking with the eyes and whatever means possible. the relativistic scientist was a reactor. It needed a kind of bouncing off something to be able to see the molecules. The electron microscope is an example of that. Literally bouncing electrons off something that you're looking at. Then the probabilistic scientist actually doesn't bounce things off it, but looks at the way that what bounces back of something else. The electron leaps scattered around the atom to see what the atom might be looking like, because if they bounce back in that way, then what they bounce from might be like that. So the quantum mechanical scientist already becomes interactive, not reactive like the relativistic scientist. And then the tetrionic scientist becomes creative, because it is by our imagination that we can create an understanding of things that we cannot see. So the whole essence of mythical science is that we are looking at things that we cannot see. By looking at the edge of things that we can see, and then looking on the edge of what we can see, and trying to look into the edge of what we can see, and that looking at the edge is still classical science, that looking onto the edge is called relativistic science. That edge is actually called the speed of light, or the event horizon. The whole philosophy, the whole mentality is based on that edginess of what we can see or cannot see. And then looking into it is what quantum mechanical science or scientists do. That is then called the electron leap or the quantum leap, which is where the material loses itself. It's the electron leap, now you see it, now you don't. That's what the Schrödinger cat metaphor was about. Now you see it, now you don't. If you don't see it, what can you infer anything about what you do see? Boltzmann and others try to fuzz that over by using statistics. Say, well, now you see it, now you don't means you might see it or you might not see it. So imagine that you see it, imagine that you not see it. Where could you see it? Where could you not see it? And then they started to fill it in. That's why it's called probabilistic science. They didn't know and pretended that they know. It's a science of pretense, a good guess, guesstimates, judicial guessing. And the guessing is based on what you know, but it is basing itself on what you do not know. So that's where you lose your reality. It's where you have no access to science anymore, and you need to go into what you don't know. You need to go into assumptions, and that is why I now use the term mythical science. At the edge of reality, there are dragons and they blow smoke, or at the edge of reality, you have quanta and they don't blow smoke. The problem lies therein that mythical science uses words which we know to describe something we do not know. It's like having a stick to prod into the fire. You hope that the stick won't burn quick enough. If you take a metal rod, it won't burn, but at some point you cannot hold it in your hands anymore. So there are words, there are models, there are examples that we have of an understanding of, say, physical materials, classical science, which in a way we can still apply, but limit it for molecular relativistic science, which is a process science. And we can actually not really use it to prod into the atomic, the transformational science, quantum mechanics, and we certainly cannot reach into that what is the intangible. It's like trying to use a stick to measure the depth of a black hole. when the stick goes in, the black hole will chew it up. So the more stick you feed it, the more stick you can feed in. We will always have that difficulty in going from classical to relativistic to probabilistic science, for the simple reason, as the alchemist said, that we need to shift from the earth element to the water element to the fire element and in to the air element, and in the fire element nothing of what we have can subsist. System theory helps us by reformulating that. It says it's a state of processes, transformation and information, and based on that the zipper of manifestation helps us define that in a slightly different way, that we have a physical reality of bound electrons, we have a chemical reality of electron circulation in the molecules, we have a transformative reality in the electron leaps in the atoms, where the electric and the magnetic are in direct interaction, and we have a reality without any particles in the quantum domain. And what we need to account for, and what science doesn't account for, and what goes wrong also in medicine, because they forget to account for it, is that when we are dealing with the physics or the anatomy, it's different than the process, which is the physiology, which is different from the electromagnetic dynamic of the regulatory system, which is very much different from the information level of consciousness at the subatomic domain, at the immaterial domain. And in describing it, we also need to realize that we are shifting from one kind of thinking to a totally different kind of thinking. So there are still scientists who think that reality is verifiable, repeatable, predictable, and they forget that that only applies for material science with fixed electrons. And so when they assume that that applies to anything, they're living a myth. It's false. The A gives B only applies in the inert material scientific realm of fixed matter, and as it is invariant, because verifiable, repeatable, predictable means that it is invariant, there's no change. But if it is not changing, it is closed system. Another word for closed system is hell. So the science of dead matter is this science of death, or the science of hell, and you cannot apply that to other things, or living things. Chemists know that. They realize that A gives B is not applicable. They say A gives B, but B gives A. It depends on the conditions. It depends on the chemistry. It depends on the conditions of the chemical reaction. And in relativistic science, that is a given. There is no fixed frame of reference. It is always relative to something else. Probabilistic science is even more acutely aware of that. They're more clearly aware that they are not able to define anything, because they are at the level of definability of everything, because they're dealing with the electron leap, and as said before, now you see it, now you don't. When the electron leaps first, it is there, it looks as if it is material science, so to say, and then it leaps. You might still see it leap, which makes it equivalent to the relativistic science, because you can still see the motion of the electron moving if you could look that fast. And then the electron is gone. You cannot see anything. So you can only see there is a not electron here, but there's not electron everywhere. So at the level of relative physics science, you cannot talk about definite things anymore. So science has become a myth. But at the deeper level, it becomes mystical, because you can only infer that what you know from the material might apply to the immaterial, And it is thanks to Tetrionics that that now becomes a given, because Tetrionics simply says the quantum domain forms and moves all forms of matter. So it creates the subatomic particles. It has a beautiful page to describe all of that. Then it creates all of the atomic dynamics. There's a beautiful book to describe all that. Then it goes into all of the chemical, beautiful book to describe all that. And then it goes into the physical, beautiful books to describe all that. Apart from those descriptions, we need to address that we are describing it. Every description of science is a formulation of our sciencing. Every scientific object is a model, but we modeled it. So what is the modeling that we do? And in a science which has ignored what consciousness is, they cannot see how the quantum field operates within us. They cannot see how we operate with the quantum field and modify the quantum field. So it is not possible to see that the ideas which the scientists work with are immaterial. And that's the mythical part of science as well, that the scientists keep on talking about things that are scientific and about material science and findings of science and scientific objects, and they ignore the part that their ideas for them are just as tangible and just as real and just as, let's call it, physical, coherent, steady state, reliable, as the material objects. And they don't compute that the objects of the physical world and the objects in their mind are equivalents. I tend to use the word equivalent. So they're identical because they are the same principle. They're equivalent because they have a different form and operate in a different domain. So in that transition between objects of science and objects of thought, we can now, thanks to Tetrionics and thanks to the science of life, come to a much better understanding of what we are dealing with, because everything that has been described as a physical object by science is actually a mental construct. So if we stop describing it as a physical object and a real thing, then we can go back to it is actually a realization. We created a realization. And in creating the realization, we are working with ideas, and we are working with ideas which for us are as tangible in the mind as the physical things are for our body. And then we can make the shift to see that there is a science of the mythical. There is actually a mythical science, because the myth is something that we create. And Campbell has done a lot of work on that. Jung as well. We use symbols and we use thoughts because we can create thoughts. We can create symbols. Symbols are still in the physical domain. They're tokens, they're glyphs, they're representations, drawings, paintings, and all that on material substance. It's like something projected onto the material. But they originate from something that we do in our thoughts. So the symbol represents something that takes place in our mind, and which in our mind is coherent. We can move it, we can transform it, we can break it apart. The body of knowledge has an anatomy, the body of knowledge has a physiology, the body of knowledge has a regulatory system, and the body of knowledge is an information system. So suddenly we can make that switch from objective science to subjective science, and that will be a topic in itself. And what we are dealing with is, in that transition from objective science to subjective science, we by necessity need to operate mythical science, because there are things that we don't know and we fill them in, we fuzz them in, we pretend that we know while we don't know, but we cannot define how usable it is. We have an unreliable knowledge, and as a result of which also essentially an inconsequential knowledge. Mystical science, however, is very different, because mystical science is aware of how we create knowledge. Mystical science knows how we transform ideas. Mystical science knows when ideas break down and need to be replaced by other insights. So mystical science is very much connected to how we work with ideas and ideals, how we change them, how we transform them, and how we create them and destroy them. That's a generation, operation, destruction. The God principle is also what we operate in the creation of our thoughts. And so in a mystical science, we have this clarity of what we're dealing with, because we know when it no longer is valid. And in mythical science, we ignore that, and well, then we pretend to know that we know what in fact we know. So when people say, yes, E equals MC squared, they do not know about the relationship that Einstein was looking at using Minkowski mathematics to actually not use vortex mathematics, but yet working with vortices, and as a result coming to an understanding of changes in a time domain with different time orbits, as a result being able to change space and velocity into acceleration, because space is simply if you have a straight line, velocity would be if you turn that into a circle, acceleration would be if you turn that into a smaller circle. Minkowski mathematics lends itself to that, and when you do that, you can see that by the mathematics of the description, you can define a relationship between space and time, but that actually was based on Einstein's perception of a light ray, in which he replaced the waves by, let's say, circles, had circles behind each other, and then based on that thought of a light ray, created the theory of relativity and all that came from that. When you add to that understanding the realization that you cannot have a light ray without having wave envelopes and wave soliton, a set of harmonics associated with it, then you immediately come to a different kind of model with different kind of outcomes, different kind of insights that are possible, different conclusions. That change of perspective from, say, the Einstein light ray to the tetrionic light ray is called a paradigm shift. And the paradigm shift I already mentioned without naming it when I talked about this transition from classical science to relativistic science to probabilistic science to unified, let's say, tetrionic science, and the corresponding shift of involvement of the scientist. The scientist as outsider observer for classical science, as reactor in relativistic science, as interactor in probabilistic science, and as creator in tetrionic science. Scientists don't describe this. They still don't talk about their involvement. They still don't acknowledge their change of involvement. And by denying that, by not acknowledging that, that too creates a large amount of the mythical science. As a result of not knowing what their involvement is, they're not really clear on what they're seeing. As a result of not knowing what their consciousness is, they're not clear on how they are looking. As a result of their not understanding how they operate consciousness within them, they also do not know how they operate thoughts, forms of consciousness within them, and thus lose themselves in what they're looking at. And they cannot make the connection between their level of consciousness their form of involvement, their specific type of outlook, and the resulting kind of realization which comes out of that. And that's the fun part of introducing this concept of mythical science. Building up on this top of ignoscience, we need to know what we don't know. Then we can go into mythical science, which is we can stop pretending our pretense. We can simply acknowledge that we don't know, and instead of saying equals mc squared and this is now a given, as if we need to be gullible, we can actually ask the question, okay, what was Einstein taking as his standpoint? What was his outlook? What was he looking at? And then we can start to look at what did he see. We cannot skip those first three steps: standpoint, outlook, object of observation. We cannot just pretend that what he describes is a reality, because we need to know his involvement. We need to know how he compensated for being an outsider of something that he was looking at. We need to know why that specific object was chosen instead of something else. We know that in his research he couldn't look at molecules, so he used he looked at grass seeds instead. For anybody who knows dimensional analysis, described by Henry Langhaar, it is evident that when you look at things at the scale of the molecules, it is very different than when you look at things at the scale of grass seeds floating on water. You need to have dimensionless parameters to be defined, you need to have the transformation equations to be defined. But when those are left out, then the clarity of the scientific description or the mathematical description becomes unclear. Then we can no longer assume that what is described applies to anything. We can only conclude that it describes to exactly what it has been describing, and that if there is a specific kind of mathematics or a specific kind of model that comes out of it, we can see where else that model can be found, where it can be recognized, which shifts the perspective from looking at the object to looking at how we use the mind. And then we need to shift again, what is the kind of mathematics that we are using, and why are we using that specific type of mathematics? And that is where we then shifted the attention from the mind to the way we use ideas and the way we work with ideas. And mythical science helps to zoom in on that. By introducing the concept of mythical science, we can the word then becomes demystify science, which is the wrong word, because we actually need to go from mythical science to mystical science. We need to go to the science of consciousness, we need to go to the science of perception, the science of involvement, the science of ideation, the cognition of consciousness as a whole. And that is why I like this idea of mythical science. Because when we start to look at what we cannot see, when we enter into the twilight zones of things, as the Indian culture says, can you see the difference between the rope or the snake on the road when you're stepping around in twilight? As the Muslims say, can you discern the gray hair and the white hair of the camel as the dawn breaks? So by addressing this concept of mythical science, we are invited to look into our capacity to discrimination, and to acknowledge when what we know is no longer applicable, which means that we need to define the edges of what we know, that we define the limitations of the models, that we need to acknowledge our ignorance in what we do. And that is so very important, because it makes it possible to shift from objective science to subjective science, which is a topic in itself.